All right.
I have no idea.
Okay, so Reformation, on to a little bit of light in the middle of all this.
Yay!
Woohoo!
Jesus, you're faithful.
Huh? Yeah, we sure are. Of what? Oh, it was Genghis Khan?
Almost a Christian if we all acknowledge that he was the sovereign ruler of the world.
That's only
one step away, man.
Yeah, he was like...
So was I watched this movie. You can't get it at Blockbuster. It's a documentary. It's kind of, well, no, yes. But it's on Genghis Khan. It's when it's from his... It starts with his childhood.
Uh-huh.
His real name is like Temujin or something like that. His real name is like Temujin. And it follows his life from being a child to where the movie kind of ends, where he's like right in the climax of him taking over the world, or taking over
at least his part.
Huh.
No, it's called Genghis Khan.
Yeah, I download a little thing. We might watch it if we have time here.
I just watched it like 2 weeks ago.
It's really nuts.
Yeah.
The Mongolian Empire is...
My brother's...
It's really nuts. That's odd.
We should all go to Mongolian barbecue and watch this.
Amen.
Good. That's the Lord.
That's the Lord. That's the meat.
What Lord?
All right.
So major monasteries of the Middle Ages. I don't know why I have that on there. A major movement of Reformation and Reform was started with the Cistercian Reform, which began with a guy, Robert of, and I don't know how to say this French name. Mollesme? Huh? Is it Mollesme? All right. Robert of Mollesme. So he started, because if you remember the Cluniac Reform that happened in the 900s, he started a Cluniac monastery in Mollesme with five other guys, and really intense. I forget. It's another example of a couple people died in the situation because the fasting was so intense. And so he established a monastery in Mollesme, and then he left Mollesme with 20 other monks and established a monastery in Citeaux, which at the time was, nobody wanted to go there. It was just a marshland, and so they kind of drained the area, established a monastery. And so it was kind of a God squad at the time. And his leaders, the two guys, Alberic and Stephen Harding, this is a classic picture of his main two leaders. And this is Robert, and they are venerating the Mother Mary. That's the question. But it was out of the Cistercian Reform that you ended up having, you know, the Cistercians were extremely radical at the time as far as their lifestyle and how they functioned. I just put down there, strictly disciplined in their schedule, footnote number 12, fasting regularly. They only ate fresh and dried vegetables, sleeping in a common dormitory, praying together at least 6 hours a day. And so you had a really intense kind of lifestyle that later kind of went the way of all the other reforms and had large, lavish monasteries. And but at the beginning, it was really intense. I'm not really sure. I mean, when I was in seminary, about an hour away, there was a Trappist monastery which came out of the Cistercians, and it's where, what's his name?
Thomas Merton.
Thomas Merton. It was his monastery. And so all I really have in my mind for real concrete is how they prayed together. And it was, I mean, it was a Cistercian monastery, so I don't know if that's... But all they did was just kind of, it was kind of recited prayers and hymns and such that they sang. So I'm not sure how they really functioned. Point two, Bernard of Clairvaux was a Cistercian monk, and so he was part of French nobility, and he left with a number of other French nobles, young nobles, and they all entered the monastery together. And it was kind of, it was the radical thing to do at the time, which you could kind of do if you were rich in the situation. And I don't mean to sound negative. I just have a hard time with Bernard in a lot of ways, just because he had so many things happened in his life, and I really shouldn't have put that picture up there, so I'm just going to skip down. So many things happened in his life. Bernard was really one of the main reasons why Mariology became so prominent in the Catholic Church. It was there before Bernard, but Bernard was the one who really exalted Mariology and the venerating of Mary, and Mary as the primary intercessor between God and man. Bernard was probably the primary guy, and I'll go ahead and it's said that he actually had a vision in Clairvaux while he was praying of the Mother Mary and him receiving milk from her breast. And so he was like, I know it's a little comical, but it's reality. Like he was the organizer of the Second Crusade because they had lost part of the area and in the Holy Lands, and so he was the primary one to push that. He actually wrote the rule for the Knights Templar and had a really strong... It wasn't like you couldn't be saved outside of the monastery. Like, it was theoretically possible to Bernard, but the only real way that you knew you could be saved was if you became a monk. So, I mean, there were signs and wonders, and there was definitely a devotional spirit, no doubt about that. But his level of involvement with the kings of Europe and everything else, I have a hard time with Bernard. And so I'm sorry if that's going to rub off on you, and I wish it wouldn't, but you get me. You get all my issues. So page six, Peter Waldo. You have the mendicant preachers. So you have the monastic reformers with the Cistercian reform that comes out and Bernard. But then you have the mendicant reformers. There's three major mendicant reformers: Peter Waldo, Francis of Assisi, and Dominic de Guzman. And those... You don't often hear about Peter Waldo, but they were all three contemporaries. They all three lived at the same time, functioning together. You don't hear about Peter Waldo because the Pope didn't have a dream about Peter Waldo, and so he got condemned as a heretic, while the Pope did have a dream about Francis and Dominic. And so their orders got established, whereas Peter Waldo's order did not get established. But they all three said basically the exact same thing, and all three functioned the same way. And so Waldo was a rich merchant from Lyon, France. He heard a sermon on Matthew 19, and in context to a testimony of a saint in the 5th century. And he did kind of have a little bit of an attitude, and so, I mean, they all three kind of had an attitude, but Waldo's was a little bit more intense. He issued an ultimatum to his wife to sell all of their possessions. His wife didn't really care for that ultimatum, so he gave her the estate that he owned. He gave all the rest of his possessions to the poor and kind of led a traveling band of homeless guys. The thing that...
Without his wife?
Without his wife, yes. So there's something a little funny in the situation, obviously. She wouldn't sell the estate was the point. So you have really the Waldesians, what they got condemned for was primarily their translation of the scriptures into the vernacular. And so he was condemned at the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, which Dominic and Francis were both at the time. And so the Waldesians were tortured and were killed by the Inquisition in France. I don't know how many, but probably thousands over the years. And ultimately, the Waldesians ended up combining with the Reformed tradition out of Geneva during the Reformation. The second guy, Francis of Assisi. Francis was... We obviously don't have time to go through Francis's history, and we'll do it in a couple weeks after spring break. We'll do it a little bit more. But you kind of have the same dynamic, only he wasn't married, where he heard a sermon, gave all of his money away, got disinherited by his father, kind of gathered a traveling band of homeless guys, and went to the Pope to get an order established. And it was really just because the Pope had a dream that night. So here's the Pope sleeping, and he had a dream in which the church was resting on Francis's shoulder. And so the next day, he allowed Francis to have an order, a religious order, and so it kind of went on from there. It kind of spun out of Francis's control, where it went in the matter of, I don't remember how many years, from 10 years, from 1215 to 1225, 26. It went to where he had about 5,000 people within the order, but his leadership, I think about 3 years before he died, kind of kicked him out, and he left his own order, and the thing kind of went on its own, and he kind of lived in obscurity until he died.
Why did they kick him out?
Because they wanted to own property. Because it was easier to function as an infrastructure with a central base and property. So Dominic is the one. The last couple weeks, I've been so gripped, I can't get away from it. So many stories and testimonies floating through my mind. So it's strange to me, but Dominic's been my swirl for the last couple weeks. Was the contemporary of Assisi. They actually met in 1215 around the, nobody knows exactly when, but it's sources on both sides of the story. People who chronicled the lives of both said that it happened, that Dominic had a vision of a poor beggar who was, I forget the exact terminology, but doing great things. And so the next day on the street, he runs into the poor beggar that he saw in his dream and embraces him, and later finds out that it's Francis. So Dominic was from Spain, whereas Francis was from Italy. Dominic's mother was a visionary. She had visions and dreams all the time. And so she had, while Dominic was in her belly, she had a dream of a giving birth to a dog with a torch in its mouth that lit fire to the whole world. And so that's generally, you know, as far as art goes, the Dominicans were characterized by, with that picture, a dog with a torch in its mouth. And he was referred, Dominic was referred to as the Lord's Hound, because he tracked down heresies intensely. So, yeah, he grew up, became an Augustinian monk, and for years he preached against the Albigensians in France. And the Albigensians were a Reformation movement, or they considered themselves a Reformation movement. They were intensely into fasting and prayer, except they were intensely Gnostic. And so... Dominic, which has put Dominic in a difficult position because their lifestyle was right, but their theology was just the same as Marcionism. They didn't believe, they believed the Old Testament wasn't really of God and that there was differing gods between Old and New Testament, etc. And so the Pope had set out kind of Inquisition style attacks against the Albigensians. And so Dominic was kind of fighting on both sides against the people killing the Albigensians and him trying to convert them. So the famous confrontation, I just put in the footnote, where he rebuked the Bishop of Toulouse and the papal legates from traveling with soldiers in a crusade against the Albigensians and 1208, saying, "It's not by the display of power and pomp, cavalcades or retainers or richly housed palfreys, or by gorgeous apparel that the heretics win proselytes. It's by zealous preaching, by apostolic humility, by austere, but by seeming, it is true, but by seeming holiness." And so he's saying, he rebukes the bishop by saying, the heretics are winning people not because of their power or wealth. It's because of their zeal. It's because of their humility. It's because of their preaching that they are winning converts. And so he says, "Zeal must be met by zeal, humility by humility, false sanctity by real sanctity, preaching falsehood by preaching truth." And so you have later on, the Franciscans and Dominicans are the primary missions force that happens later on. And so by the year 1400, oh, it's the other way around. Look at that. I really thought it was the Dominicans that had most of the missionaries. Oh, so I'm wrong. Never mind. Anyway, move on. Point C, in 1215, he was granted an order of preaching friars, and 1218 he set out across Europe on a 3,000-mile trip that he did entirely on foot and spent a lot of his nights just sleeping on the side of the road in the midst of that. And it's that trip from 1218 to 1221 that most of his miracles and signs and wonders and four people got raised from the dead all happened on that traveling trip. And then he got sick and died in 1221. And so then it spread from there. Point C, you have the mystical theologians. I put on there, So the mystical theologians, this is the point in the outline where I ran out of time and I really need about two more weeks to research and work out the rest of the outline, but time evades me at this point in my life. And so I just left on here my notes from when I taught the class in seminary, so it's just kind of random, you know, pieces of information, but hopefully it'll be somewhat helpful to you. So you had your monastic reformers, you had your mendicant preachers, and then you had the mystical theologians all kind of setting the stage, and then finally the Reformation forerunners that all kind of set the stage for reform during this time of the church. Your mystical theologians, Johann Eckhart, or Meister Eckhart, was a German Dominican. And he was the first one to really publicly denounce the whole medieval scholasticism. And he set the stage for other mystical theologians that focused on union and communion with God as of primary importance. And it's those guys that were the guys that Martin Luther drew most of his theology from, primarily John Toller. And John Toller, I mean, he wrote like 1,000 sermons, but they're all the exact same sermon, just with different names, and they're all reworded a little bit. But he was the primary guy that Martin Luther got all of his, and he fed himself off of John Toller. And then Gerhard Grote was another guy in the Netherlands who was heavily influenced by Eckhart, and he established a monastery there out of which came Thomas A. Kempis and the Imitation of Christ, which the Imitation of Christ is, I think, besides the Bible, the most printed booklet of any book in history. Anyway, so, but all that came out of kind of the mystical theologian movement. Then point D, the Reformation forerunners, you had two primary Reformation forerunners, John Wycliffe and John Huss. Wycliffe was in England, John Huss was in Bohemia, and Wycliffe was, you've probably heard a lot about Wycliffe, which is where we get the Wycliffe Bible translators and the whole Wycliffe movement, because his major push was on translating the scriptures into the vernacular, into English, which got him condemned, and not just condemned, but he wasn't just like disliked. And I just put on here, they actually, the Catholic Church actually came in and dug up his bones in 428 and burnt them and destroyed them as a public act to show their hatred for the Lollards, who were the followers of John Wycliffe. And so a lot of Wycliffe's followers were killed.
When did English come onto the scene? Because we kind of just transitioned into English, like, when did the actual English language, how did that come apart? Because we were like Roman Empire, Greek, Latin, Germanic languages.
Yeah, I mean, you had the Saxons came over in 1066, and Old English was happened, I think, during from like the 12th to 15th, 1200s to 1500s. Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know linguistic history. I think it's just a Germanic language that kind of developed as the Normans and Saxons came over from Germany. Yes, the English language is barbaric. And then point two, John Huss was a professor of theology at the University of Prague, was also influenced by Wycliffe, got condemned and burned at the stake, but he had more of a following than Wycliffe. He had a following that lasted for hundreds of years, and it was the Hussites that were actually, it was Moravian Hussites that were fleeing persecution that came to Zinzendorf's property and took up residence at Herrnhut. So the Hussites were a fairly substantial movement. Page eight, I just put missionary, major missionary movements. The only real major missionary movement during this time, which I would say there's more than just Northern England, but this is, as far as missions history, Northern England or Northern Europe was the primary missionary push, because there's a lot of missionary push in the Far East among the Mongols, and there was some missionary push among the Muslims. So it wasn't just Europe, but this is where a lot of it happens. So a lot of these are basically the same story over and over, and again, not very pretty missions, but you have like Denmark, where you have the king makes the country Christian by force, and either you get baptized or you're banished from the land. And so in differing situations, depending on just how it worked out within the situation, you had more genuine baptism and more genuine converting, because you're also talking about a communal, more tribal type society. And so if your leader, if you're in a communal tribal type society, if your leader says this is good, he's older, he has been ordained by God or the gods to be the leader over you, and therefore he knows what's best and has been given divine wisdom, so you just say yes and you follow his lead. It's not, they weren't living in a post-enlightenment type world, so it wasn't as bad to them as it seems to us, though there was definitely negativity at the time. It's just not as bad as we kind of tend to, when you read through the history of it, as we think. So Norway, you had Olaf Tryggvason, who was real famous. Olaf was the one who really set the stage for the church being established throughout Scandinavia, and then Iceland, and then with the Finnish. What to cover here? I mean, it really is, like I was reading through here going, yeah, it's really just the same story over and over. Iceland was kind of a different story in that you had a lot more kind of, as Stephen Neal says, a democratic accepting of the gospel, which simply means that it was presented to the people in a less harsh way. And so, but Iceland, its constitution was formed at that time, around 1000 AD. Its constitution was formed around Christian principles. It was formed around the nation being baptized as a whole. And Iceland, it's known as the oldest parliament in the world. From that time of its conversion, it's had the same parliament and the same constitution ever since then. So Greenland, you had a guy who was baptized under Olaf Tryggvason in Norway, who went out to Greenland. And then you had Sweden, was the same kind of situation in which Cistercian monks came up from southern Europe and the king was baptized. And then Finland was also, the king was baptized. Page 9, you have Prussia, which this is kind of bleeding over from the 10th century into the 11th century, in which, based around the Holy Roman Empire, you had different countries being baptized and functioning in relation to kind of feudal society in Europe. And so as it spread further out into Lithuania and Prussia up through here, you kind of had the same story. And so Lithuania, this whole area up through here, was ruled by the Teutonic Knights, and it was the same idea. Either you're baptized or you're banished. Point B, Asia. Like we saw last time, after the inhabitants of Kiev, which was the major trading center for the whole region up here, they all got baptized, and out of Kiev came missionaries that went out towards the east. And you have a couple of those, St. Theodosius and Stephen Karp, who were, you read about in the book, and spread the faith. So point 2, Mongolia and China, though the Assyrian church was decimated by the Five Dynasties and Ten Kings period in China, it was revived substantially during the 11th through 13th centuries, only to die out again during the 14th century as the Mongolians accepted Islam en masse. And it really, it wasn't like kind of an event where the Mongolian Empire accepted Islam. It was just kind of the culture of Islam took over slowly but steadily. And at the same time, the Mongolian Empire kind of broke apart into pieces. Point one, as seen originally, the Mongolians were seen as allies to the church because as Mongolia came over, they came over into Eastern Europe, and they threatened coming into Europe, but that's so far away from its headquarters, which was here, that they just kind of stopped once they got past Kiev. But they, the stories of them coming into Eastern Europe and what they did in Kiev, it's said that they destroyed every inhabitant of Kiev, and that some years later, people, reports came back that years afterwards, you went to Kiev and there were still bones of people piled up where they had just piled up the bodies and moved on. And so the reports of the devastation of the Mongolians coming in came into Europe, and the church, which was fighting against Islam coming up from Spain and coming over from the east, the church's first response was, we need to make allies with these guys because the Mongolians hated the Muslims, because the Muslims were the primary, I mean, the Muslim empire stretched out into here and all over Arabia. And so the Muslims were the primary obstacle to the Khan being the divine representative and ruler over the whole earth. And so the church sent two major trips of people over to meet with the Khan and try to set up an alliance between the church and the Khan. But both times, the Khan was like, no, what are you talking about? I'm the divine, I'm the one that the Most High has anointed, because they had a belief in a Most High God that was actually involved and sovereign over the earth. And so their belief was, I'm the one appointed by the Most High to rule over the whole earth. Why would I make an alliance with you against the Muslims when I'm going to conquer the Muslims and you eventually? And so it was kind of like, he really did. Yeah, you're exactly right. So there wasn't a message telling him, you know, instead of a message telling him that Jesus was going to come and destroy his empire, the message was, let's join forces against the Muslims. However, they were, go ahead. They were, they had, the Mongolians were known for having all sorts of different people, even in their court, of differing believers, of Buddhists, of people they had taken over in China, of just kind of tribal shamans, of Nestorians and Christians. And so it's said that Genghis Khan, because it was kind of standard procedure as they spread out and took over the empire, they would raid their enemies and take women from daughters of the rulers of their enemies as their own wives or for their sons. And so Genghis Khan took a wife from one of the Turks, and it's, there's not a lot of history, but like we talked about the week before last, where the Turkish Empire was supposedly all Christian and the king was Christian, and so one of the daughters of the king, he took for his son, a wife for his son, and that woman, who was a Christian, had three children. one of which was Kublai Khan. And so it's clear that there were a lot of Christians in the mix of the Mongolian Empire, but people don't know like how many and how influential the Nestorian Church was. However, the first delegation of people that went over, point two, Father John of Plano Carpini, I guess, was a Franciscan who went over, and the Khan obviously rejected him, but he said that while he was there, that there was a tent of people in there was an area in the court of Nestorian Christians worshiping and holding services all the time. And so I don't know what all the time means, like if it was 24/7, but he said it was, I mean, there were also Buddhists, you know, and other people, but anyway, so point three, the Mongols captured Baghdad, Damascus, the Nestorian Church flourished throughout Asia in the midst of the Mongolian Empire. However, the Mongolian world ended up getting absorbed by Muslim culture. So the second major delegation was sent by Marco Polo and his uncles. Oh, so here's the expansion of the Mongolian Empire. And then it kind of got separated out into four different regions. But you can see it as it came over into Eastern Europe and then kind of pulled back because just really difficult to run an empire that big.
Is the largest empire in the world? Huh? In a very short time, they conquered all of the world. That is the largest empire.
Yes. Definitely the largest empire of all time, yeah, as far as human history.
Oh, it's only maybe 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
That's a short amount of time to conquer, man.
Right.
And now they're such a passive, backward
people. The Mongolians? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Mongolia is... it's not the best environment. Like, they don't have a lot of resources, and it's a rough terrain. So it's really amazing that those people ended up taking over the whole world as they did.
Last Wednesday, Dr. Cerny, Tim's dad, said that scientists say now, I don't know, I mean, obviously I don't, but anyways, he said scientists said now that there's only three types of people, or all people can be filed into three different types: Caucasian, Negroid, and Mongoloid.
Huh.
That is
three sons.
Nora's son. Nora's three sons.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I was even thinking it makes sense that they married. I mean, they had the largest empire ever, and they're taking from daughters from every different country they're taking over. That's creating all kinds of different things. I mean, if they completely destroyed Kiev.
Yeah.
And Ukraine, they completely destroyed Ukraine, where Ukraine doesn't exist anymore. But they take their daughters.
Yeah.
And marry them and create kids.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
thus, you just got them
spreading out.
Spreading out.
My mom, she's a nurse, and she's working one day, and this lady says, you definitely got Mongolian or something in you. And like, to Sweden. And mom's like, no, I'm English. And the woman's like, no, go ask your father or whoever if there's any like Swedish blood in you. She goes and asks him, and it turns out that there was a Swedish blood. How it happened is like Genghis Khan or whatever, when he came over, he went into Sweden too, and like raped like all these like different women.
Wow.
Like, so my mom has Asian eyes. Like if you look at her eyes are
wow.
Yeah.
Wild.
So she hasn't even done
I just have Mongol for sure. My kids have like little.
All the Koreans are Mongolian.
I believe this kid's got a blue bone.
Yeah, both my sons had Mongolian spots on their Buddhas.
Wait,
a little blue when they're born.
Yeah.
Blue on their Buddhas. It's called a Mongolian spot.
Yeah, Mongolian spot.
They're both heads and Silas had it.
What?
What's up with that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm telling you,
like,
I'm Asian.
Has had a big one around his crack.
He's an Asian descendant.
Yeah. What
does it go away?
No, actually.
What idea? You
it
know
goes
the Mongolia's
away?
Part?
Did it gene? Has just go away?
Gene is strong.
It's
so
it's
that's
faint,
why
no.
You have, you know, the one time or two time just, you know, the you mix that, then your descendant have that one. That is very strong gene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That both
so,
Hez and Silas have, but Hez was even stronger. Hez was like his whole one side of his cheek was like blue.
Yeah, but it's just 1 year or 2 years and it's gone.
Yeah, and now it's gone. Now it's just like a big, now it's just like a little spark red.
What
so,
is it? I don't get it. Why?
All Korean has that one.
A blue bone?
Come on!
Bone.
I knew I was Asian. I just gotta get the family tree somehow.
Yeah.
Come on, dude.
It's the skin and
you.
It changes color.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're
it's
in, dude.
Like red.
All the way from Birmingham, Alabama.
That's right. Man.
No, dear. You
all
know, American Indian? India? They are Mongolian, too.
Mongolian.
That's why, yeah.
That's crazy because my wife, my wife's grandmother is full Taino Indian. And so that's why my wife has those big almond eyes. And my daughter Naya came out. She's red, you know, and she's got the big eyes. As well, man. So
what
I've got.
Are those eyes?
Huh? Like the Taino people have, like.
All right, so we got time. We'll watch a little. Just this is.
So
this is just
the
Caribbean. I think the BBC did a 5-part series on the Mongols, and so this is just the first 5-minute introduction to the whole series, but.
In 1162, deep in the heart of Asia, a child was born. He was clutching a blood clot, a sign from heaven that he was destined to be a great warrior. His life was to become a legend. His name, Genghis Khan. Many believe his story is simple. That he was the incarnation of evil, a brutal barbarian who butchered millions. But the real character of Genghis Khan is far more intriguing. How did this illiterate outcast turn the feuding tribes of Mongolia into a powerful nation? And how did he transform the Mongol hordes into a ruthless and disciplined fighting machine? An army with revolutionary tactics and ingenious weapons that ultimately stood poised to conquer Europe. And why on his deathbed did he believe his divine mission remained unfulfilled?
Soon I will know death, but I will never know my destiny.
Shortly after his death, his heirs gathered their memories into an epic account of his life. They called it The Secret History of the Mongols. Evidence from Chinese and Persian sources, the work of leading scholars, and the secret history allow this to be the most complete television portrait of Genghis Khan ever made. The characters are all real historical figures. And the words of Genghis Khan are rooted in the great speeches of the secret history. This is the story of how that tiny fist turned to iron and came to rule the largest land empire ever known to man.
So yeah, it's fascinating. So his son's wife was a Turkish Christian, like we talked about, and then, oh, come on, don't do anything like that.
So the Turkish woman that he had taken for his son to be a wife was Christian, and then one of her sons was Kublai Khan, and so the most famous story was that you hear about Christians and the Mongolian Empire is when the Pope sent Marco went with his uncles, Niccolo and Maffeo, I guess, and they went to Kublai Khan because Kublai Khan requested missionaries, and so when they actually came, he requested 100 missionaries, and I assume because his mother was Christian, and when they actually came, they came 20 years later, and they only came with two people, one of whom, to my understanding, died on the trip there, and the other one, it was just kind of too little too late. So, point B on page 10, the demise of the Assyrian church seems to be the result of a number of factors. In Central Asia, it was due to Islamic pressure and the Tamerlane massacres. In China, it was the change of dynasties. And so it was once this empire got, this part of the empire kind of fell apart and got retaken over by the Muslims. There was the king of the time was King Timur, and it's one of the most bloody, I forget, it's one of the top 20 of the most devastating massacres of human history, and so that was part of why the Assyrian church got decimated, was in that massacre, but I don't know a whole lot about that whole event, so. Both of which were the result of the church identification and allegiance with the political governments. As the governments fell, so did the church. The last area in Africa, so as you had, here's the spread of Islam from 630 to 750 is in the yellow, and then the orange is 750 to 1500. And so it's spread out to the area, and I think it went farther up here because it went into the Mongolian Empire a lot more, but I may be wrong. And so then after 1500 is in the red. So Africa, you had differing voices who argued that the Crusades really were wrong and there were actually attempts to go into Muslim territories and preach the gospel, the three main people being Roger Bacon, Francis of Assisi, and Raymond Lull. Francis of Assisi actually took, I think, three different trips and met with the Egyptian Sultan, but nothing really came of it. Raymond Lull was the only person who really kind of developed a substantial mission into Islamic territory during the time, and so this is just a historical picture of kind of his account and him getting stoned at the end of his life. So that's about all I have for class. We'll go ahead and wrap up early. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah, so we'll head over, the guys on the Tuesday fasting team, and again, we'll meet at 2:15, like 2:15 to 3, in the same side room. Have it. That side. Go ahead.
I have the thing, the wine of the spirit corporate gatherings that my Mike shared yesterday, the dream, and some other three confirmations came about on that. I picked up a few, if you guys go ahead and get it. Thank you for getting this.
I thought it was Hebrew.
No, we just have to read that day, like weekly. We don't actually have to choose a book for on that one.
Okay, what's the book review?
On any of the other three books, you can choose.
Those three books. Which ones?
The For the Familiar, or Let the Nations Be Glad.
No, you have to do all three, but one of them is due tomorrow.
Which one's due tomorrow? Does it matter?
Any of the three.
And what is it, a two-page paper report?
He emailed us all the details on what he wants in the paper. Lettered it.
When did he email it?
Several weeks ago.
When we go to Mongolia, only this one month came.